Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Raven Real Spill. This is your girl, Raven the Serial Poet, coming to bring to y'all another night of 31 Days of Horror. I hope everybody's day has been going splendid. My day has been full of clarity on all levels. And I hope that y'all enjoy tonight's show. But before we get into tonight's show, I just want to say this. If you made it up to this point, if you went and listened to the playback, if you listened to the live show, or whatever the case may be, if you supported Raven Real Spill Radio in any type of way during these 31 days of horror, I want to say thank you. I want to say thank you. I appreciate you. I love y'all. I want to send y'all positivity and light. Because y'all can listen to any show on Blog Talk, and y'all probably do. But y'all take time to carve out a slot for me. And I ain't going to get all sentimental and emotional and stuff because y'all ain't come here for that. But I just want to say that y'all are definitely appreciated. And follow your girl. If you don't follow me already on here, send your girl to follow. Share the show so somebody else can follow. Because, you know, sharing is caring. But anyway, if you want to tune in, the number is 914-205-5813. That is 914-205-5813. We're going to get into the show. Let's go.
It was April 2015. Me, my girlfriend, and my little brother, who was 9 years old, had gone to a small nearby movie theater on a Wednesday night to see the horror movie It Follows. We usually went late on weekends to get the whole theater to ourselves. Plus, I had off on Thursdays that semester. When we entered the theater at first, It seemed like we were the only ones inside the theater. But then my little brother pointed somebody out. He was a man in a dark gray hoodie, sitting in the top left corner seat in the theater. It was a little sketchy, but nobody would really give it a second thought. We picked upper middle row seats with a railing in front, and we each sat with an empty seat between us for more room. I know that sounds weird to do with my girlfriend with me, but having my brother there made it a different story. I was sitting closest to the edge, therefore the closest to the one other guy in the room besides us. Within 5 minutes, previews were over and movie was starting. The lights in the theater dimmed to darkness, and the only light now was the light projecting from the screen. My little brother took out his bag of candies he snuck in and started to eat them obnoxiously loud. About 5 minutes into the movie, over my brother's loud candy wrapper noises, which we told him to stop for the record, I thought I heard a pretty loud sound come from above and behind us. I waited a few seconds to sneak a glance behind us and saw that the guy that was sitting in the top corner had moved down a row, which was odd. But again, I didn't give him more than a second thought. Another 5 minutes later, when the movie was already starting to get interesting, again I heard a sound come from behind us. Again I turned when I thought it wouldn't be too obvious, and again the guy was a whole row closer to us. I leaned to my girlfriend and said while chuckling, "Don't look, but the guy keeps moving closer to the screen." She shrugged her shoulders and didn't even show interest in checking. I told myself if he did it again, then I would have a problem and manage to get back into the movie. I'd say another 5 minutes later, without even hearing anything this time, I just turned around with curiosity and saw the man a whole row closer, and this time he wasn't at the last seat of the row anymore. He was moved further down the row closer to us now. He was only 3 rows behind us. I nudged my girlfriend, and then she turned around. Then she looked at me and gave me a confused, concerned kind of look. She asked me if we should move, and I said definitely not. At this point, I wasn't able to pay attention to the movie anymore. Even though I was facing the screen, I felt like the man's gaze was hitting me in the back of my head. I told myself if he moves closer, I would turn around and firmly ask what he was doing. But then I also thought, what if I'm looking too much into this? What if he's just a normal guy who happens to keep switching seats for better view? Once more, I turned around and the man was only 2 rows away from us now. Closer to the center of the row, or rather, directly behind us, and head just completely down looking at his lap. I didn't even bother to check what he was looking at. He could have been looking at nothing. I literally opened my mouth, ready to say something, but I was just too much of a coward. I was only 16 last year and pretty skinny. My little brother got up during a slow part of the movie to go to the bathroom. About a minute later, I turned to see if the man had gotten closer again. This time actually ready to say something, but I was shocked to see nobody behind us. It was completely empty. I told my girlfriend and she said, "Good." But then I stood up in pure fear, thinking of my little brother, telling my girlfriend to wait there and running out of the room and into the empty theater hall. I saw the man in the gray hoodie entering the man's bathroom down the hall. Fearing for my little brother's safety, I ran down the hall towards the bathroom. Opened the door and saw the man literally on his knees, peeking under the 2 stall doors. Then he looked at me, and at the same time I heard my little brother call me from down the hall. I ran to him, got my girlfriend out of the movie room, and we went to the front desk. The team working in the front ticket stand called the police and showed us and the cops the video footage of the man walking down the hall, and then we filed police report. I'm just so grateful that my brother went to a different bathroom down the opposite direction of the hall. Cause if he had been in there, even with my showing up to save him, I have no idea what would have happened. It's been over a year now, and the man was never identified.
This is a very weird story that took place a few months ago. I still live in the same house this happened in. I have an electrical outlet under my bed that I use to charge my phone with. I leave my phone up on the ledge above my bed every night, usually using it as an alarm. However, something strange started happening on a Monday night in February. I woke up to my alarm clock blasting. Only it was still dark out. I looked at my actual alarm clock sitting on my desk. It was 4 in the morning. I wasn't sure if I'd accidentally set a new alarm. The alarm was titled Down. I unset it and went back to sleep, not overthinking it. The next night, I woke up again to the sound of my phone's alarm clock blasting. I saw that the time was 3 in the morning, and the alarm clock title was set to Beneath. No way had I set that alarm. I would remember something like that. I figured my brother was playing a joke on me somehow. The next morning, I told my dad to tell him to stop messing with my alarm clock, that it's interrupting my actual sleep on school nights. But he swore on his life that he had never touched it, and I kind of believed him. That night, I put a password on my phone and wrote it on a sticky note just for safekeeping. I hid the sticky note on the wall behind my bed and made sure no extra alarms were set. The only one was set for 8 a.m. I fell asleep, but once again, I woke up to the blasting alarm clock in total darkness. 2 a.m. The alarm was titled, Duh. I was a little freaked out now. Something was really wrong with my phone. I was sure someone was hacking into it. The next day, I left it off for the whole day in hopes that whoever was messing with it would forget about it. And that night, I used my actual alarm clock on my desk as an alarm instead. I set it to 8 a.m. and went to sleep. But when I woke up, there was once again no sunlight. My alarm clock was off, so I couldn't see the time. It was my phone. It had been moved to the ledge. But the alarm clock sound wasn't the usual marimba. It was some kind of distorted screaming sound. I turned off the alarm, which was titled Bed. It was 1 in the morning. I was laying there clueless, not knowing what to think. My phone was at 10%, so I reached down under my bed to try and find the charger that's normally plugged into the wall. It was missing. And then, at the worst possible time, I realized exactly what it all meant. The four alarm titles formed a sentence. Down, beneath, the bed. I tried to pull my arm away, but it was too late. I felt a hand grab my arm and squeeze tight. I screamed as loud as I could, loud enough for all the neighbors to hear. I heard my parents' bedroom door open and footsteps running over to my room. My door opened and my dad barged in with a baseball bat. He saw that I was being pulled down to the edge of my bed. My dad reached under my bed and grabbed a hold of the man hiding under. He knocked him out with the bat and called the cops. The man clearly didn't plan that out, as he basically trapped himself under my bed. Police told us that he is a registered sex offender who had been arrested 10 times. He's extremely messed up in the head, and clearly gains pleasure from messing with and scaring his victims. It scares me the most that he was in our house and under my bed for 4 days.
When my best friend Lizzie and I were 18, we went on our first vacation alone together to London. We were staying at the London Marriott Hotel. The first thing we did upon arrival was, of course, to get there and drop off all our luggage. We'd be there for a whole week, so we had to set our itinerary. It was late in the day already, so we didn't have much time that day, but we did want to see something at least. So we went to see Big Ben, which is that iconic big clock tower that everyone knows in pictures when you think of London. After that, we went to a nearby tavern for dinner called St. Stephen's Tavern. Just money, but good thing our dads were paying for this trip. After leaving the tavern, it was like 9 o'clock and we were wanting to go out and experience the nightlife. We agreed we'd first have to go back to the hotel and shower and change first. As we were walking, a young attractive man overheard us talking about the nearby bars we were looking at on our phones, and he stopped us. Something about him immediately was just charming that grabs both my and Lizzie's attention, and if it weren't for that, maybe we wouldn't have been so receptive to him telling us about a big apartment party that one of his rich friends was throwing that night, and that two attractive ladies like ourselves wouldn't fit right in. Lizzie and I looked at each other and laughed. We said we'd be down and he said, great, the party doesn't start till 11. He asked for my number, so I gave it to him. Then he said he'd text me the details and see us later, and down the street he walked. Lizzie and I were super excited. It was only the first night and we were already invited to a crazy London party. We figured if we played our cards right with the wealthy people at this apartment party, we would have people to hang out with the rest of the trip. We got back to the hotel, showered and changed, and we pre-gamed with a little vodka first to loosen ourselves up. Think we drank more than we should have though. I texted the guy we met, realizing we didn't even get his name. He texted back quickly with the address to the apartment. So we loudly marched into the street to wait for our Uber. It was a 15-minute Uber drive to get to the apartment. And when we got there, we couldn't believe how different the architecture of this apartment building was compared to something back home in America. I pressed the code for the apartment and we were quickly buzzed in. We took the elevator to the 5th floor. We were excited but nervous, not knowing what to expect. The alcohol was definitely helping though. I knocked on the door to the apartment, but we didn't hear music inside, which was odd, until the young man from earlier opened the door. He hugged us hello and welcomed us into his dead quiet apartment. He shut the door and we asked, "Where is everyone?" He said, "Oh, it's still early, don't worry." We looked around the apartment and it was not at all as big as we were expecting for an apparent rich guy. We asked where his friend who owned the apartment was. The man said he was getting things ready in his room. He told us to sit and make ourselves comfortable. Remember looking at my phone and seeing it was like 11:30. Lizzie and I sat down and I could tell by her face she was as put off by this as I was. The man sat down on the same couch as us, next to me. He was uncomfortably close. Suddenly another man came out from another room. He didn't say anything. He didn't smile as he walked towards the door to the apartment. And he just stood there. The man on the couch with us started asking us questions like where we were from and if there was just two of us visiting here. I started feeling sick to my stomach. The man next to us got up and went to the kitchen to get us some drinks. The man by the door stood there. Lizzie was to the left of me, so she was more hidden from view. I whispered in her ear to dial 911, and I noticed her tapping on the phone multiple times, indicating to the call taker that we needed help. Lizzie then suddenly called out loudly to the man in the kitchen, "This is apartment 5C, right?" The man at the door said yes in a deep, unfriendly voice. I whispered to Lizzie again that we needed to stall and not to drink any drinks the man gave us. As I was whispering to Lizzie, the man standing at the door called to the man in the kitchen to hurry up with the drinks. And then he came back from the kitchen with the drinks. I had to think on my feet to stall as long as possible before drinking. Whatever he just said in front of us, I put on a fake and bubbly persona and said we should play Would You Rather. I know it sounds juvenile, but I had to think of a game that didn't involve drinking. The man seemed to play along with it. So me and Lizzie started coming up with would you rather questions, and he started coming up with some of his own, but he would often suggest we take a sip of our drinks, saying the guest would be there soon and that we needed to loosen up some more. I stalled for as long as I could, saying we already drank a lot, but we'd be down to drink more in a little bit. I remember when things were about to turn really south, the two men looked at each other. Then the bigger, scarier man at the door came over and said, "All right, drink your drinks." He was about to reach for one of the glasses, probably force in my face, and there was an aggression banging at the door, followed by a man shouting, "Police!" The younger man looked at us and asked, "Did you call the police?" "No, why and when would we?" But my voice cracked as I said this, indicating I was nervous. Lizzie apparently just decided the hell with my story and screamed, "Help!" The police started to attempt to kick the door down, but the bigger man screamed, all right, and opened the door with his hands up. The two men tried playing innocent. Lizzie and I had to fabricate the story a little bit, saying that the two men basically forced us into the apartment and wouldn't let us leave, and we were pretty sure that they drugged our drinks. That was enough to get the men arrested. A second police car arrived to escort us to the station for further questioning. The drinks were tested, and it turned out to no surprise they were roofied. This was definitely a scarring experience, but we didn't let it ruin our trip to London. In fact, we never told our parents until years later, just because it would probably make them less likely to let us travel anymore. The alcohol definitely didn't help our initial decision making in the night, but our advice would probably be, don't ever trust strangers, no matter what they look.
I remember it like it was yesterday. I woke up late thanks to me forgetting to set up my alarm the night before. When I saw 7 a.m. on the clock, I sprang out of bed and began pulling my clothes on furiously. I needed to be at my bus stop by 7:05. So that meant I had no time to have breakfast today. I hurriedly scooped my books and worksheets into my backpack and dashed down the stairs and out of the front door. There was my bus. The last kid got on board before the bus took off. I hastened my sprint as the bus began pulling off. But the driver sped up and I was left behind, dejected, listless, and without a mode of transportation. My school was about 20 minutes away from the bus stop. I had no money and had never really ridden the public bus. My 10-year-old mind was in a complete state of panic. I knew my mom would kill me if she found out from my teacher that I had skipped school. For around 10 to 15 minutes, I was standing over there, puzzled, thinking what to do next. I looked up and noticed a car pull up in front of me. The driver's window was already rolled down, and I could see a middle-aged man sitting in the driver's seat, gazing at me. He flashed me a toothless smile before speaking. "What's wrong, kid?" "I missed my bus," I said, with an air of defeat. The man stared at me for a moment before responding, "You need a ride?" I had been taught to never talk to or accept rides from strangers. Still, I was a desperate 10-year-old who didn't want to get into trouble for missing school. "Yeah," I said. I hopped in and slammed the door behind me. The inside of the man's car was filthy. There were cans and old food packages on the back seat, and the smell was overwhelming. I coughed and reached to let down the window.
"Sorry, kid, the window doesn't work, and neither does the door from the inside," said the man.
I looked at the man, who was looking at me intently. There was a hint of glee in his dark eyes, and I was beginning to feel very uncomfortable.
"Where do you go to school?"
he asked, and I told him. The man smiled again and began driving. When I looked at the driver's seat closely, I saw what appeared to be a little girl's rainbow-colored bracelet hanging on it. My uneasiness was out of control, and though I tried to look away quickly, the old man caught me looking at it.
"Oh, this. It was my daughter, Jessica's. She's no more now. I think about her every day."
I stared out of the window to notice that the man was going in a completely different direction than what my bus usually takes.
What happened to her?"
I asked numbly. The old man was quiet for a few seconds before answering.
"Well, she passed away in a car accident. The roads are dangerous, you know, especially in this town."
My heartbeat was increasing by the second. I wondered if the old man had been lying about the door not working. I was strongly considering yanking at it anyway.
"How old are you, young lady?"
the man asked. 10, I replied quickly, trying to hide my nervousness, but failing miserably.
"That's how old my Jessica was when she passed."
I looked out of the window and I felt relieved. We were on the street my school was on. "How could have we gotten here so quickly?" "The man might have taken some kind of shortcut," I muttered to myself. The car pulled down in front of my school. The man hopped out and walked over to my side and opened the door for me. I climbed out of the car and said, "Thank you for the ride, sir." The man nodded and gave me another smile. He got back into the car and drove away. I watched him go, wondering what the hell had just happened. What had my 10-year-old intuition been telling me? This man was clearly harmless, or else I probably wouldn't be at school right now. I shook my head and walked into the building. To my surprise, all the teachers were crying. I didn't find out why until a while later. My bus had never made it to the school. A car had hopped unexpectedly into the bus driver's lane, and he had swerved hard, causing the bus to topple over the side of the bridge. There were no survivors. The next morning, I was reading the newspaper. There was news about the accident of my school bus. There were photos and names of the students and the bus driver who lost their lives in the accident. I was sad, looking at the pictures and reading their names. There was also a picture of the car driver and his daughter whose car bumped onto my school bus. I was shocked to see the picture of the car driver. It was the same man who gave me a ride to my school in his car yesterday. I remember him telling me that his daughter had died in a car accident. I looked at the name of his daughter. It was Jessica. I just realized that the man who dropped me at my school was already dead.
I'm 25 years old, and this story happened to me about 4 months ago. I was doing some late evening shopping at my local Sam's Club. I was looking for items to put in my new apartment and wanted to look at some TVs they had on sale. I think it was around 8 p.m. when I entered the store. The first thing I noticed before entering, however, was a man who stood there near the entrance. He gave me a very long, intense stare. He didn't look well at all. He looked very on edge and jittery. He was wearing a New York Giants cap, a black tank top that had holes in it, and skinny black jeans. He had a poorly shaven face and big red bags under his eyes. I remember looking around at some kitchen appliances when I noticed that the guy from outside was standing in the same aisle. I didn't think twice about it, but after I kept seeing him in almost every section of the store I went to, I wouldn't necessarily say he was stalking me, but it did raise some awareness. After picking up a few items, there was about 25 minutes left until the store closed. I walked over to the TV section and tried to pick out a decent TV that was on sale. I saw a TV that I liked, then out of nowhere I heard a deep voice ask me, "You need some help, man?" I turned around and it was the guy who'd been lingering around me. So I answered, "No, that's okay, thanks," I replied in a firm voice. He then walked off without saying anything. I picked up a TV I liked and I went to check out. I started putting my items into the car. And the TV I tried to put in the back seat, but it didn't fit, so I had to put it in my trunk. Once again, the same guy from earlier came up to me asking me if I needed any help. I told him no, this time in a more impatient voice, and I quickly walked off with the shopping cart to put it back. Thankfully, after returning to my car, the guy had left and was happy to drive home. About 5 minutes into driving, I took a glance in my rearview mirror, and I saw those same baggy red eyes staring right back at me. Before I had a chance to do anything, I felt a hand grab my face, covering one of my eyes, which made me lose control of my car. I crashed into a parked car. The man then climbed over and stole any change I had laying around, grabbed my wallet and keys before quickly running off. A passing car stopped to help me. Thankfully, I wasn't badly injured, only a few cuts and bruises. The Sam's Club and the police were informed of what had just happened. The police checked the security cameras and found the guy just lurking around the parking lot most of the evening, trying to get into unlocked cars and looking for change on the ground. It also showed when I walked away to put the shopping cart back that the man snuck into my car and hid while my back was turned. I think he was some kind of drug addict. Maybe. Maybe he needed some money badly. I'm glad the only thing he took was some cash, even though he almost took my life.
As a former Uber driver, I've dealt with a whole bunch of unpleasant characters, from the drunken groups of friends on Saturday nights, to the people who pretend to be handicapped to get free rides. But every so often, you may pick up somebody who can just be classified as a straight-up creep. I've picked up a few of these guys, but never one quite as bad as a guy named Tom.
It was a Friday night of the year. I had nothing to do, so I figured I'd do some late-night pickups. This was 2 years ago. I was 18 and had a new Honda Accord. My parents kind of spoiled me a bit. I was a very skinny 18-year-old, though. That's why my dad told me to always keep a blade in my car, because you never know what kind of nuts are getting into the car. A guy named Tom popped up a couple miles away by a major shopping area. I responded to his request and started driving in that direction. I pulled up in front of the shopping center, where I saw a group of teenagers hanging out. It looked like trouble. I hoped this Tom guy wasn't part of this group. A bunch of them looked at me in my car as I slowly passed. Eventually, I just hit the gas and went further into the parking lot of the shopping center, wanting to get away from this group. I did 2 laps around the whole parking lot until I finally noticed, through my left mirror, somebody approaching my car from behind. I rolled down my window and called out Tom, and he called back, yes. I told him to hop in. I had to repeat myself 3 times, and given that all I was saying was hop in very clearly, it made the situation very weird from the start. The 4th time, he finally understood me and walked slowly around the back, getting into the seat right behind me. Usually the people I picked up would sit diagonally from me, which is what I preferred. When people sat right behind me, it just made me a little paranoid sometimes, especially when the person seemed kind of creepy. This guy was old. He had to be in his upper 40s. Where to? I asked him. He told me an address, which I entered into my phone. By his voice, I could tell he was a very heavy smoker. Come to think of it, my car was starting to smell like cigarettes, too. The address he gave me was 10 miles away, which was fine, since it meant I'd be making more money. I tried making small talk initially, which didn't work out too well. Like, if I would ask him a yes or no question, sometimes he would just mumble, and any other questions led to dry responses. I stopped talking when he completely ignored one of my questions. I was within just 5 miles. There was still 5 to go. By the 6-mile mark, things started getting uneasy in there. I was afraid to look into the rearview mirror because I was so sure that he was staring at me. I took a quick half-second glance and saw I was right. He was in fact staring at me. My body forced my foot down heavier on the gas. I wanted this ride to be over sooner. By the 8-mile mark, I started to realize we were in the middle of nowhere. We were on basically a deserted street with woods on either side and occasional buildings. I was growing suspicious now as to where this address he told me actually was. So, while driving, I dragged my finger across my phone to slide the map in the direction of the address. It seemed to lead to a dead-end street with no surrounding streets nearby. I was getting more and more nervous with each passing minute now. I shot a glance back up again at the mirror, and he was still watching me. I finally summoned up the courage to ask him if the address he gave me was of his house. There was silence for a few moments, and I thought he was once again going to ignore me, or possibly didn't hear me. But 5 seconds later, he finally answered yes. There was less than a mile left in the drive now, still surrounded by nothing but woods with the occasional empty-looking building. I was approaching the dead-end street that the address he gave me resided on, hoping some houses would come into sight. As the street came up, I slowed down so I could get a good look of it. But nothing could be seen. Just pitch blackness. I could only imagine why he wanted to get me out here alone, so far away from anybody or anything. I casually kept driving, pretending like I missed it, hoping he wouldn't notice, but he did. Instantly, he hopped out of his seat and yelled at me to turn around. Honestly, I felt like my life was on the line, so I apologized and did a quick 3-point turn. As I was reapproaching the dead-end street, I dug my hands into the netting compartment on the side of my seat where I kept my blade. I very quietly flicked the blade open and held it tight in my right hand, ready to use it. I turned down the dead-end road, with my headlights now displaying just what I thought I would see. Nothing but trees on either side. I made it to the end of the road, not a single house or building on the road. I just knew something was about to go down. I was just trying to physically and mentally prepare myself for it. Suddenly, he said in as soft as a voice as he probably could, "Thanks for the ride." I wasn't even thinking about money at this point. He opened his door, but before stepping out, he said, "Could you get out of the car for a second? I need help carrying my bag. I have a bad back." But he didn't have a bag. I knew he didn't. He didn't come in with one. I replied, Yeah, sure, let yourself out and I'll help you in a sec. The shakiness in my voice was too obvious. What happened next, I never imagined would have happened. All of a sudden, I felt pressure on my neck. It took me at least a second before I could realize he was choking me from the back seat. Immediately, I drilled the blade into his left arm, and he screamed in pain, releasing his grip on my neck. He fell out of the car and onto the street, and I took that opportunity to turn the car around and practically floor it down the street until I returned to a busy road. I actually didn't end up calling the cops. I was just too scared to do anything but drive home. And by the time I got home, I just wanted to go to sleep and forget about it. Needless to say, I resigned from my Uber driving days after this incident.
I deliver food for a nation eatery in my town. It's the best gig I could get at my age simply for the tips alone. My friend and I work there together. We are actually the only two who are Asians. My friend usually works the counter and takes phone calls. I usually do deliveries and that's the way I like it. My friend got off the phone during one night shift we had together and told me I'd be doing a delivery after the food was prepared. I was handed a brown paper bag and I was off on my way to the address. That address led me to some small dirty driveway off the main road onto an enclosed property and the house seemed to be closed off. Given that there wasn't a single light on in there and how high the grass was, I called my friend back at the restaurant and he gave the phone to his boss. Unfortunately, our boss is a stench in a steak Asian accent to knock on the door and don't waste the food. I got out from my car and felt grass rubbing against my shins. That's how tall it was. I went up the 3 stairs to the front door and knocked really loud since there didn't seem to be a doorknob. As I expected, after 30 seconds of waiting, there was no answer. So I got back in my car, and the first thing I did was start texting my friend back at the restaurant. But when I looked up back to the house, this time one of the upstairs lights inside of the house was turned on. So I went back to the door and knocked once again. Only on the first knock, the door pushed open slightly. Someone had opened the door, but there was nobody standing next to the door. I pushed the door open a little more and called out, "Hello." My voice echoed through the empty house. I was waiting to hear footsteps come to the door, but they never did. Obviously, someone had to have opened the door, so if they weren't going to come to the door, I had to assume they wanted me to come in. I stepped into the house as my shoes made the wood floor creak. I called out one more time and this time someone replied back. I heard the words, "Aquí arriba now." I'm not fluent in Spanish by any means, but I knew that aquí meant here, and I knew arriba meant above. So I put two and two together and figured they said up here. There was a stairway in the middle of the hallway, so I walked over it. I stopped at the bottom step. I looked up the stairs, and all I saw at the top was an arm reached out over the ledge, doing a little stiff come here motion. I used what little Spanish skills I'd gained from middle school and said something like, "Tengo tu comida," as I walked up the stairs. As I got about halfway up the stairs, the arm wasn't there anymore. I got to the top for whoever was just standing by the ledge over the stairs, and I noticed through the tiniest amount of light that the person was now inside a bedroom with the lights turned off. But I didn't see the actual person once again. All I saw was the person's arm doing the same come here motion. It's as if anything about the person's elbow was faded to black in that room. It was such an eerie sight. I knew for certain that I wasn't going in that room though. So I said firmly with confidence, "Buddy, I'm not going in there. You come out here with money or I'll leave." Suddenly the arm pulled away into the darkness of the room ahead of me. And after a few seconds of standing there in silence, I was hit by a flying object. It happened so fast that it took me a few moments to realize just being hit with a stiff, severed arm. It wasn't some plastic Halloween toy. It was a real arm. I ran down the stairs with the food still in my hand and got back to my car. I drove straight to the nearest neighboring house and rang that person's doorbell. When they answered, I told them about what their neighbor had just done to me. And the woman had the most puzzled look on her face. She said nobody's lived in that house for a year. I felt my stomach dropping. Those words hit me. She said she would call the police after we talked about it for a good 5 minutes. Then I went on my way back to the restaurant with the food. I explained the best I could to my boss, and he let it go. I sometimes wonder how things would have played out if I went into that room, and who or what I would have found.
My sister's gone, and an online video has something to do with it. I found my sister watching a video online last night, and I've tried to figure out what it was. I was going to her room to tell her she had to go to bed, but as I approached her room, I heard a voice that wasn't hers. A quick look in showed me that she was watching a video. Before I tell you what I was hearing, let me explain the site she was on. It had a pastel-colored frame around it that consisted of flowers and hearts. In the very center of the page was a video player. The video was of a person in a bunny costume, like one that a mall Easter bunny would wear, but it was creepier than even those ones are. I don't know what it was about it, it just didn't look right. The point of this description is that the website itself was very inviting, and I could see it being very appealing to children with lots of bright greens, pinks, and blues. The bunny in the video was speaking directly to the camera, but I didn't notice that for a moment. As I walked up to the room, I heard a cartoonish voice ask,
"Do you think you can do something for me? Shake your head if you can."
That's when I poked my head around the corner and saw the screen, as well as my sister subtly nodding her head. I quietly kept watching.
"You have a mommy, a daddy, a brother and a sister, right?"
My sister nodded.
"They all told me they want to come play with me, but they don't want you to come. That's not very nice, is it?"
My sister shook her head.
"I am gonna come to your house and pick only one of you to come play with me. Do you know what you have to do if you want me to pick you?"
My sister nodded.
"Good. Can I count on seeing you tonight?"
"Okay."
My sister nodded.
"I can't wait. Your brother is watching us. Get him first."
That's when I burst into her room. I got to her before she could click away from the page she was on. By this point, I was under the impression she was on a Skype call or something, but to my surprise, it actually was a video. I went back to the beginning, and the video played through the exact same way. I asked her why she was on the website, and she shrugged. I thought to get the URL to do some research, but it was just a random jumble of letters and numbers. I clicked exit on the page, then went back and deleted her history. Then she went to bed. I went on my laptop and searched for any kind of site with some semblance to the one my sister had been on. The video wasn't on YouTube or any other video hosting page. I couldn't find a single shred of evidence that the video actually existed. I went to sleep, and after tossing and turning from wondering how the video was so coincidental that it said, "Your brother is watching us," I fell asleep. The next morning, I woke up to a quiet house, which is a rarity there. I found my parents in bed, both stabbed to death. My younger sister, the one older than the one I told to go to sleep, smothered with her pillow. And my sister, who was watching the video, nowhere to be found. The only evidence of anyone else being there was a stuffed bunny, with the likeness of the bunny from the video, sitting on the couch in our living room, with a note in its lap. The note read, "We'll be back for you. Smiley face." The police are currently investigating, but have no leads.
What happens if you call 666? 666 is known by most as the number of the beast, or the number of the devil. There is actually a name given to the fear of the number 666. It's hexaphobia. Did I pronounce that right? I have no idea. But it exists. Look it up. It's real. As is what I'm about to tell you. So what happens if you call 666? Let me show you.
Your call cannot be completed if dialed. Please check the number and dial again.
That's what most everyone gets. This doesn't work, because it's too easy.
Your call cannot be completed if dialed.
So if you're watching this video, you're probably wondering, is it really possible to speak with the devil? The answer is, yes. If you don't want to know how, please stop watching this now. Here's a question. Are you a gambler? Did you know all the numbers on a roulette table add up to 666? Okay, if you call 666 666 times, on the 666th time, you'll get this.
Call cannot be completed if dialed. Please check the number and dial again.
Sounds familiar, right?
Your call cannot be completed if dialed.
Let it linger for a while.
Please check the number and dial again. Your call can be completed as dialed. Please stay on the line. You have called 666. Your call has been completed.
That's creepy for sure, but it gets worse. Your phone will ring back, not necessarily right away, but at some point. And you'll hear something like this.
Hello? Can you help me? Please? I'm lost.
According to the 666 tracing website, the following voices have been tracked. Girl, 7.
Can you help me? Please? I'm lost.
Boy, 10.
Hello? Can you help me? Please? I'm lost.
Girl, 5.
Hello? Can you help me? Please? I'm lost.
And girl, 11.
Hello? Can you help me? Please? I'm lost.
They say that this is the devil making contact. If you call 666 666 times, you too may receive a phone call from the devil. I pray it won't lead you to hell. But if it does, I'm sure I'll be seeing you there.
My name is Chris. And this story happened to me last year when I was traveling with my dad across the United States. We were traveling in an RV. We were visiting Nevada. And of course, we had to go and check out Area 51. By the time we got there, it was pretty late and quite dark out. So we thought we would just park the RV, sleep, and check it out in the morning. That night, I think around 1 a.m., my dad was asleep. And I was playing some games on my iPad when I heard some footsteps outside our RV. I took one of my earplugs out so I could listen better, and it sounded like someone was slowly pacing. I took a subtle peek through our blinds. It was pitch black, but you could kind of see something moving. I woke my dad up telling him someone is out there. He took a look out the window and then told me to get a flashlight. I asked him, "You're not going out there, are you?" In a concerned voice, of course. But my dad said, "We have to see what it is." Nervously, we both went outside. We shined our light towards the figure. It looked to be a man with his back toward us. My dad spoke out, "Hello?" No answer, or even any movement. My dad spoke again, "Hello? Can you hear me?" As we slowly got closer, you could see the man was wearing some kind of gown, like a hospital gown that patients wear. The man was still unresponsive. We got close enough to tap him on the shoulder, and the man slowly turned around. He looked kind of pale, as like a ghost, and his eyes were black, like they weren't even human. He stared right at us, and my dad stepped back in shock. Then we heard a noise. It was more footsteps. My dad shined his light in a direction, and what was right in front of us were more men. Men in patient gowns, black eyes, looking right at us. Me and my dad ran back into the RV and drove as fast as we could away from the Area 51. We spent the rest of the night in the motel we found. We never went back to Area 51 after that. When I was really little, my parents would let me stay up late on the weekends and watch TV until I fell asleep. I really loved these times. It would stay up later than anybody else just because I could. Well, one night, I almost fell asleep on the couch when I heard a noise on our front porch. It was the sound of our old-fashioned porch swing moving back and forth. I was a little scared, so I crept toward the bay windows of my living room and peeked out towards the porch. Sitting on my front porch swing was an older woman, probably in her 50s, wearing nothing but a nightgown, covered in blood and holding a huge kitchen knife. I flipped out immediately and ran screaming into my parents' room, but was too terrified to form the words. My parents saw that I was upset, but when I finally was able to tell them what I saw, my dad got really angry and told me that I was just dreaming and to go to bed. I refused and kept crying and screaming until he had enough and snatched my arm and dragged me towards the front door to prove that nothing was there. I kicked and screamed all the way trying to make him stop, but he kept pulling me. Finally, we got to the door. He unlocked it, swung it open, and said, "See, there's nothing that..." To this day, I have never seen the look of fear and shock that was on his face when that woman turned and stared at both of us and slowly stood up with that knife. My dad slammed the door shut and got my mom to call the police while he went and got his gun. He went back to the door. He asked her what she was doing, and she said, "Somebody killed my husband, but it wasn't me." My dad told her that the police were coming, and she freaked out, grabbed a knife, and walked away. The police found her 15 minutes later trying to break into our neighbor's house. I never slept in that living room again.
The following story was told to me by a Japanese friend of mine who said that she read it in a newspaper. I haven't actually seen the newspaper, so I don't know whether it happened or not. There was a group of teenage friends, two boys and two girls, who went to the same high school. One night, they were having a small party in the house of one of the boys. It was after midnight, and the talk soon turned to scary stories. The friends wanted to test their courage by going to a haunted location. They thought it would be fun to scare themselves by exploring a creepy place in the dark. For years, they had heard stories about an old abandoned school that lay on the outskirts of a town. Everyone said it was haunted. None of the teenagers actually believed in the ghosts, so they wanted to scare themselves. And it seemed like the old abandoned school was the easiest place to explore. One of the girls had a car, so they drove out to the schoolhouse and parked outside the grounds. The four friends decided that they would explore the school individually. The plan was for each individual to walk around the house anti-clockwise. It would take about 10 minutes to circumnavigate the school. The first individual would start off, and when he returned, he would tell the others what he had seen. Then it would be the turn of the second individual to walk around the school. The first individual, a boy, set off as the remaining three teenagers waited by the car. After a while, they began to grow impatient. It had been more than 20 minutes, and their friend had still not returned. After 30 minutes had passed since the first individual left, the others got tired of waiting. The next girl decided to walk around the school and look for their friend. The two waited and waited, but the girl too failed to come back. The remaining two couldn't understand what was happening. They began to wonder if their friends were playing a joke on them. It had been almost an hour since the first guy had left. The boy and girl who remained behind were very nervous. The girl began to cry and the boy tried to comfort her. Eventually, the boy said,
"I'm going to look for the others. If I don't come back after 30 minutes, go straight to the police."
After he left, the girl stood alone in the cold and the dark, weeping silently. She waited an hour, but nobody came back. She got into the car, turned the keys in the ignition, and drove to the nearest police station. Four police officers accompanied the girl back to the school, and as dawn began to break, they launched a search for the three missing teenagers. At first, they couldn't find any sign of them on the school grounds, but then they discovered that the side door of the old, disused school gym was standing open. The police went inside. It had old, rusty gym equipment lying in it. There was an eerie silence in the air. It was when they looked inside the toilet in the gym that they found the three missing teenagers. They were all hanging from the ceiling by their necks. The police questioned the surviving girl, and she swore that she had been telling the truth. The three teenagers had gone to the abandoned school to test their courage. They had no reason to commit suicide. However, after spending weeks trying to solve the problem, the police finally closed the case, saying they could not find any evidence that the teenagers had been murdered. In the end, the incident was explained away as a case of mass hysteria. The police claimed that the three teenagers must have been involved in some kind of suicide pact. To this day, nobody in that town will dare to venture out to the old abandoned school after nightfall.
I had cared for an elderly woman with no family who came to us when her husband died. She didn't speak often, but when she did, it was usually just words that made no sense together. I felt so bad for her because ever since she had arrived, so many of the residents in the area that she seemed to enjoy spending time with had passed in such a short time span. She put up a picture of each of them next to the picture of her husband and several others who were probably family to remember them. I had always just felt sorry for her and showed her extra attention that we eventually became close. It just seemed so unfair that she had such luck and kept losing people she cared about. One day she looked at me and said plain as day, "Sweetie, I think I'm done now," and handed me a picture. It was a picture of me and I smiled because it touched my heart that I was that important to her. She passed away nearly a week later and I cried for days. It hit me really hard. She knew it was the end for her and she said goodbye as best she could. A little less than 2 years later, I was talking with a colleague and that elderly woman came up in the conversation. My colleague referred to her as that crazy bitch, which seemed very out of character for her, and it shocked and offended me deeply. I expressed this to him not so nicely and he looked at me with his shocked look and said, "Oh dear, do you not know?" And then explained something to me that I had not known. As it turned out, it came out after some time she had passed that she had killed her husband by poisoning him, and that there was an investigation because it appeared that she had a ritual of befriending someone, obtain a picture of them, and hiding the picture until she could kill them, usually by poisoning, and then displaying a picture as a sort of trophy. After listening to this, I was shocked. I was thinking about the picture of mine she had given to me. It meant that her next victim was me, as I was the person who was close to her. I let that go. I didn't think much about it. It was my night shift. I was in the same ward in which elderly woman used to stay. It was a different patient in there this time. He was sleeping. When I got into the ward, I was thinking about the elder woman, and at that moment she appeared in front of me. She was sitting on the chair where she usually used to sit. She had my picture in her hands. I was shocked, and within 4 to 5 seconds she disappeared. This was some kind of hallucination, I thought to myself. Maybe my mind is playing some tricks with me. I went out of there. Whole night and on my way home, I was only thinking about the incident that happened to me in the hospital. When I reached home, I tried to find the picture which elder woman had given to me. To my surprise, the picture was missing. And then all of a sudden, my room's light started to flicker. This was scary. I just ran out of my house. Luckily, just out of the house, there was a police station. I ran into the police station. I explained my situation. Police did investigation but didn't find anything. They couldn't do much as the woman was already dead. After the series of these incidents, I felt paranoid to work in that hospital and also to stay at my home. Due to mental issues, I just left the country. I shifted from Canada to Australia. It's been 10 years now. I have never seen the elderly woman after that, and I hope I will never see her again. A few years ago, there was a lady who lived near a mental hospital. One night, she was at home watching TV, waiting for a phone call from her brother. He was flying into town to meet her and was going to call when his plane landed. It was a very stormy night. Suddenly, the television program was interrupted by a news bulletin. The newsreader said that a crazy woman had escaped from the local mental hospital. The doctor said that the crazy woman was very dangerous. She had killed 12 people before she had been caught and sent to the mental institution. They also said she was obsessive-compulsive and was obsessed with light switches. The woman was distracted by her phone ringing. It was her neighbor from across the street. He told her that the lights upstairs in one of the windows kept flickering on and off. The lady thanked for letting her know and hung up the phone. She thought it was probably just an electrical problem, but she decided to go upstairs and check, just in case. In the darkened hallway, through the crack under the door, she saw that the lights in one bedroom were indeed flickering on and off. Gripping the door handle, she opened it cautiously. The room was empty. The fan in the room was on, and it was blowing a coat hanging beside it. The coat kept knocking the light switch on and off. Relieved, the lady turned off the fan and went back downstairs. A few minutes later, there was a knock on her door. It was her neighbor again. He told her that the lights upstairs were still flickering on and off, but this time it was in a different window. Together, they went upstairs to check it out. When she opened the door of the room, the lady found it empty. The lights were off. Her neighbor stepped into the room and began switching the lights on and off again and again. At this point, the lady decided that her neighbor must be imagining things. So she thanked him and escorted him downstairs. After he left, the phone started ringing. Her brother called to tell her he had arrived at the airport.
"You don't need to pick me up," he said. "I'm getting a taxi. I'll be there in about half an hour."
Hello? Hello? Are you able to hear me? Hello? Hello? You're not audible to me. Hello? Then, on the line, he heard a rapsy female voice say,
"I will follow you."
There were four teenage girls who lived in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Their names were Ying, Spicy, Nana, and Sis. The girls had been best friends for years, ever since they started school together, and they shared an interest in ghost stories and horror movies. They had heard an urban legend about their school. According to the story, a girl went missing one of the school's bathrooms, and it had been locked up ever since. The girls decided that they would break into the bathroom when nobody was looking and take a look around.
I wonder what we'll find, said Spicy. Maybe we'll find the girl's corpse.
That evening, when classes had finished for the day, the girls gathered outside the bathroom. The hallways were deserted and all of the other students had gone home. Ying used a hairpin to pick the lock and the door swung open. The bathroom looked clean, but it was empty. When they checked one of the stalls, they found a camera lying on the floor. The strange thing about it was that it was still working and the battery was full. Sis picked it up and started flicking through the pictures. There was nobody in the photos. They were all empty shots of parts of the bathroom.
It looks like they were snapping photos in the dark. I wonder what they were up to, said Nana.
Oh my god, I think I know. They were trying to capture a ghost. You're supposed to go into a dark room and snap photos, and if it's haunted, a ghost will appear in one of the pictures.
Ying was a little freaked out by this, and she wanted to leave.
Let's take a selfie before we go, Sis suggested.
Ying, Spicy and Nana posed together while Sis snapped a picture of them. Then they left, switching off the lights and closing the door behind them. As Sis was on her way home, her phone started ringing. The call was coming from a private number. When she answered it, she heard a strange, rasping voice on the other end.
Delete.
It said.
Delete.
Then the call suddenly ended. Sis wasn't sure what to make of it. She assumed it was just someone calling the wrong number. When she got home, she plugged the camera into her laptop and started looking through the pictures again. When she came to the photo she had taken of the other three girls in the bathroom, she noticed something odd. Nana's hair looked strange. Sis decided to give her a call, but Nana didn't pick up her phone. A few minutes later, when she looked at the picture again, something was wrong. Nana had completely disappeared from the photo. Sis was a little frightened and she wondered if her eyes were playing tricks on her. When she took a closer look, she noticed that Spicy's hair looked much longer, as if she was wearing a wig. Sis was worried and she decided to give Spicy a call.
Hey, what's up?
Hi, something really weird just happened. Remember when we took that photo in the bathroom?
Yes.
Spicy replied. Nana was in the photo, wasn't she?
Yes.
Spicy replied. Well, she's not in the photo now.
What do you mean?
Spicy asked. It's just you and Ying in the photo now, and your hair looks really long.
All of a sudden, the call cut off. Sis tried to call her back, but Spicy didn't answer her phone. When she looked at the photo again, Sis got a fright. She almost jumped out of her skin. Spicy had disappeared from the photo and now there was only Ying standing on her own in the bathroom. Worst of all, there was someone standing behind her. It looked like a woman with long dark hair and pale white skin. Just then her phone started ringing. When she answered it, Sis heard a familiar voice on the other end. It was very muffled, but it sounded like Ying.
Delete the photos,
said Ying.
Delete the photos.
Ying, what's wrong? Sis demanded.
Delete the photos.
She repeated over and over.
Delete the photos.
Ying, where are you? Answer me, Sis demanded.
Suddenly the call cut off and Sis heard someone knocking on the door of her apartment. A chill ran down her spine. The knocking was loud and insistent.
Who is it?
Cried Sis. There was no answer. Cautiously, Sis made her way down the hallway. The knocking grew louder and louder. Trembling with fear, Sis stood at the front door and put her eye up to the pee hole. She was horrified to see another eye staring back at her. She let out a scream and ran back to her bedroom. Grabbing the camera, she quickly deleted all photos on it. All of a sudden, the knocking stopped, and there was an eerie silence. Sis room's lights went off. And when they came back in, all four girls were reported missing. The police searched for them high and low, but no trace of them was ever found. When I was younger, there was a ruined building at the bottom of our street. All of the kids in the area kept well away from it because the rumor was that it was haunted. The concrete walls of the old two-story building were cracked and crumbling. The windows were broken and shards of glass lay all over the floor inside. One evening, as a test of courage, my best friend and I decided to explore the creepy old place. We climbed in through a window at the back of the building. The whole place was dirty and there was a layer of mud on the wooden floor. As we dusted ourselves off, we looked up and were shocked to see that someone had written the words, "I am dead," on the wall near the ceiling. Probably just some teenagers trying to scare kids. "Yeah, probably," replied my friend nervously. We explored more of the rooms on the ground floor. In a room that appeared to have once been taken kitchen of sorts, we found more writing on the wall. It read, "I am in a room upstairs." We walked up the cracking stairs to the second floor. I led the way and my friend followed close behind. I wasn't scared, but he was beginning to get a little jittery. When we came to the top of the stairs, we turned left and walked cautiously down the narrow hallway. At the end of the hallway was a closed door with some more ominous writing on it. "You will find me in this room." By now, my friend was shaking with fear. I was quite creeped out too, but I didn't want to show it. He told me he didn't want to go any further, but I insisted, telling him there was nothing to be afraid of. I turned the handle and the door creaked open. We stepped into the room and found it empty. There were two closed doors on either side. There was some creepy writing on the wall. It read, "My head is on the left and my body is on the right." As soon as my friend saw this, he completely lost his nerve. He gave a yelp and turned to run away. I caught hold of his arm, but he shook me off and fled out through the open door. I heard his footsteps disappearing off down the hallway. I held my ground. I was determined to be brave and overcome my fear. Mustering all my courage, I opened the door on the right and walked inside. I walked to the other side of the room. On the wall, written in tiny letters, were the words, "My body is underneath." I looked down at the floor. I was standing on some more writing on the floorboards. I stepped back and saw the words, "My head is coming from the room behind you. Turn around." I heard the door behind me creaking and quickly turned. Suddenly, something rolled into the room and came a rest against the wall. It was my friend's severed head. His dead, sightless eyes seemed to stare at me. Screaming in horror, I flung myself out through the open window and fell two stories on the ground. In horrible pain, I ran home, crying and yelling for my parents. The police were called and they searched out the old ruined building. At first, they didn't find anything. There wasn't even any writing on the wall. They combed the house from top to bottom, but didn't find any traces of my friend. Then they pried up the floorboards. His body was lying underneath. They never found his head.
There were two teenage boys named Ben and Rick, who both shared a keen interest in the paranormal. Whenever they met, they would always have a new scary ghost story or spooky urban legend to share with each other. One fine day, Rick was browsing on the internet. That's when he came across a website that had a lot of Japanese urban legends. He read a story about a certain bridge that was located close to his home. The website had plenty of pictures of the bridge and the surrounding area. As he read the legend associated with the bridge, Rick knew his friend would be interested. The next time he met Ben, he told him about the bridge. It was an old bridge. It was known as a spot that was notorious for suicides. Every year, at least 20 or 30 people would throw themselves off the bridge and plunge to their deaths. Nobody could explain why. They said that the spot was haunted by the ghosts of all the people who had committed suicide there. When Ben went home that evening, he decided that he had to check out the bridge. He desperately wanted to see a ghost. So that very night he set out for the place where the bridge was located. It took him about half an hour to get there. It was almost midnight when he arrived at the bridge, and there was not a single person around. It was dark and deadly quiet. The atmosphere was so spooky and ominous that it sent a chill down Ben's spine. "Wow, this place is creepy," he muttered to himself as he cautiously walked to the edge of the gorge. He began thinking about all of the people who had thrown themselves down into the inky blackness. The thought of it made his hair stand on end. It was so fascinating that he felt compelled to tell his friend Rick about it. So he pulled out his cell phone to call him. However, for unknown reasons, he couldn't get any reception. There was absolutely no network at the point of time. Looking around, Ben noticed a solitary phone booth standing nearby. He went inside, put some coins in the slot, and dialed Rick's number. "Hello, Rick? Guess where I am right now?" he said. "I am at the haunted bridge you told me about. The view is amazing. You got to come up here and see it sometime." "Yeah, I would like to," replied Rick. "I saw all the pictures on the website. Wait a second. What number are you calling me from?" Ben laughed. "Oh, I couldn't get any reception on my mobile, so I'm calling from the payphone up here." His friend was confused. "Payphone? There is no payphone up there. I would have seen in the pictures." "What are you talking about?" said Ben. "I'm standing in the phone booth right at the entrance of the bridge. Hold on, I'd better go. There's a line of people outside waiting to use the phone. I'll call you when I get back home." As soon as he said that, Rick shouted, "No, Ben, don't get out of the phone booth. I know that place. I'll be right there in 30 minutes. Whatever you do, don't move." "What's wrong?" "Just promise me you'll stay where you are. Don't move an inch, okay? And don't hang up the phone. I'm coming." When his friend hung up, Ben felt a wave of fear envelop him. He stood in the phone booth and kept the phone receiver pressed to his ear. Looking over his shoulder, he saw a line of people standing outside the phone booth, silently watching him. The look in their eyes sent a shiver down his spine. Half an hour later, when Rick arrived at the haunted bridge, he found his friend standing at the very edge of the gorge. He was holding his cell phone against his ear. There was no phone booth and no line of people waiting to use the phone. If he had moved an inch, he would have fallen off the edge and plunged to his death.
One of my friends told me about a Facebook account. Some of you might already be knowing about Legend of Brian B. West Bay. It's a Facebook account. Many people have reported this account for conducting weird activities. My friend told me stories about the people who had added this account and how they received strange messages from West Bay's account. Brian West Bay is not a person. I don't know what exactly it is, but it is inhuman. When I got to know about this account, I became quite curious to know more about it. When I went home, I logged into my laptop and sent him a friend request on Facebook. Around half an hour later, my friend request got accepted. I had also messaged Brian West Bay and he replied to me too. But he never told me who exactly he is. In fact, I don't think even he knows who exactly he is. There are multiple stories about the existence of the Brian West Bay account, but one of these stories I personally feel is logical and true. The story says Brian West Bay was a normal person just like you and me. He was totally addicted to social media. He constantly used to post something or the other on social media from the moment he used to wake up to the time he went to bed. One night, West Bay was drunk as a skunk. He posted some of his embarrassing pictures and videos on Facebook. All those photos and videos became viral. He became humiliated, so humiliated that he unfriended everyone, deleted his account and eventually committed suicide by jumping off his apartment building's roof. As the story goes, the account of Brian West Bay ghostly remains. I'm a person who never believes in paranormal or ghosts. But after having encounters with West Bay's Facebook account, I might say I believe in ghosts. Getting back to my story, after doing some research on West Bay's account, I decided to send him a friend request. I also sent him a private message. When I first saw this account, there was no profile picture or a cover photo. It was completely blank. No posts, nothing. After half an hour, My friend request was accepted and my message was replied to. I had messaged him, "Hi, how are you?" I got a reply from Westway's account, "I am happy to be your friend." Everything I wrote after this was replied with one repeated sentence, "We are friends." No other response besides that. I tried saying many things to him but I only got one response, "We are friends." Out of frustration, I cursed him and asked, "Can we speak?" Suddenly an audio file was sent in my inbox. It had a very distorted sound and some whispering. And towards the end of the audio file, someone spoke.
Hello, friend.
This was very frightening. Westbay messaged me again. "We are friends." Not long after, his profile picture suddenly changed into dark, deformed, grimacing face. I looked at it for a moment. I sort of felt drawn to it. It was hypnotic. I started to get a little freaked out, so closed the conversation, unfriended him and shut my laptop down. That night, when I went to sleep on my bed, I saw his face. Not in the computer, but in the darkness of my room. It felt like it was standing on top of me and staring straight down at me. It appeared only for a split second, but I was sure it was there. He was there. Few days went by, but still I could see his face in my college, washroom, road, everywhere I go, especially at night in darker places. This was quite an annoying thing for me. Sometimes it got so frustrating that I thought of jumping off my apartment building. Of course, to get rid of Brian Westbay. I can't blame anyone for my current situation. This is all due to my curiosity. I'm here to do you guys a favor. I'm leaving Brian Bay Westbay's Facebook account link. If you are brave enough, go and click on that link. But let me tell you one thing. Do not click on that link. And if some of you are dumb enough to go to that link, I must tell you to please reconsider. And do not spend too much time staring at the profile picture, because whether you like it or not, Brian B. Westway wants to be your friend. And as far as I know, he's a friend you can't get rid of. There was a young boy who was very overweight. Everyone at school teased him and called him fat boy. His problem was that he didn't know how to control his diet. Nobody had ever told him which foods were healthy to eat and which foods were fattening. He had the misfortune of having a very strict father. As soon as he got home from school, his dad would start calling him names and telling him he was lazy and weak-willed. He forced the boy to do exercises in the morning, fed him diet pills and made him take cold showers. However, none of this was very helpful. The one thing he neglected to do was teach his own son how to eat properly. The son became very fed up with the situation. After a while, he didn't follow his father's orders. He always tried to get out of doing exercise. He spat out his diet pills and he took warm showers every day. In addition, he ate big bags of candy, potato chips and fast food. The father had to go to work, so he couldn't watch his son every minute of the day. And his mother often took pity on the boy and baked him cakes to eat. One day, the father got extremely angry at his son's lack of effort. He promised that he was going to make him thin or die trying. He said that after a month, if the boy wasn't able to do 10 press-ups on the floor, he would buy a children's coffin and make his son sleep in it every night. His boy tried his best to lose weight, but he just didn't know what to do. The month passed quickly and he was still only able to do 5 press-ups. His father flew into a rage and went out to buy the child-sized coffin. He took an axe and smashed the boy's head into pieces. Then he threw the broken wood out of the window and placed the coffin where the bed used to be. The boy's mother tried to protect her beloved son, but his father was adamant. A promise was a promise, and he had to follow through, no matter how horrible it seemed. His son was going to sleep in a coffin, and that's all there was to it. The stern father stood at the bedroom door and made sure his son climbed into the coffin. Lying in an open coffin, Rolly creeped the boy out, but he had a plan in mind. As soon as his father switched off the light and shut the door, the boy hopped out of the coffin and slept on an inflatable bed he kept hidden in his wardrobe. One night, the father burst into the room and caught his son getting out of the coffin. Enraged, he decided to come up with a way to prevent his boy disobeying his orders. He fetched his drill and drilled some holes in the top of the coffin. Every evening, his son was forced to climb into the coffin and close the lid. Then, the father would nail the lid shut. The father had drilled some additional holes in the side of the coffin to prevent his son suffocating. Sleeping in a coffin was extremely scary for the young boy. It was pitch black inside and very cramped and uncomfortable. He could barely move and the air was so stale that it felt as if someone was choking him. Sometimes the poor boy couldn't stand it anymore and began crying and calling for his parents. He even started banging his head against the lid, but to no avail. His father knocked on the coffin lid and told him that he would only be let out when he was able to do 10 push-ups. Every morning when his father opened the coffin and let him out, the boy would try to do push-ups on the floor. He tried his best, but he was so weak from lack of food and lack of sleep that he could never do more than 2 or 3 before collapsing on the carpet in exhaustion. One night, the boy's parents went out to visit their friends, leaving their son home alone. Before they departed, the father locked the boy inside the coffin and made sure he couldn't get out. However, while returning home, they met with an accident. Boy's father and mother both lost their lives in the accident. Meanwhile, the boy was lying in the coffin, unaware of what happened. The next morning, when he woke up, he waited for his father to come and let him out. But the father never appeared. The boy lay there for weeks. He was dying of hunger and thirst. Just when he was about to give up hope, he heard voices in his bedroom. The coffin lid was unlocked and opened. He looked up and saw his grandparents standing there. They helped the boy out of the coffin and gave him some food and water. The boy was painfully thin, like a skeleton, and his face was gray, like a dead man. A few years ago, I lived in a large apartment complex in the city. The building was 10 stories high, and my apartment was on the 8th floor. It was a bad area, with a lot of crime. I was planning to move out soon, so I never bothered to get to know any of my neighbors. One Friday night, I came home from a hard day at work, and I was feeling very tired. I got into the elevator and pressed the button for my floor. When the doors opened, there was a man standing there. He was dressed in all black. He was wearing a black mask and a black hoodie. It was a common thing to wear masks in our area due to flu. "Hello," I said, trying to be polite. The man didn't answer. As I got out of the elevator, he pushed past me roughly and got into the elevator and started pressing the buttons. "What a jerk," I muttered to myself. I unlocked my apartment door and went inside. I went straight into the bathroom. While I was washing my hands, I happened to glance in the mirror and noticed something strange. There was a dark red stain on the sleeve of my shirt. It looked like blood. Then I remembered the rude guy who had bumped into me at the elevator. It made me feel sick. I didn't know where the blood had come from, but I had my suspicions. I immediately locked my front door. Then I took a shower and threw the blood-stained shirt in the trash. I didn't sleep very well that night. The next day was a Saturday, and I had a date with an attractive young woman I had met. I was getting ready to leave when I heard my doorbell ring. "Who could that be?" I muttered in irritation. I was already late for my date and I didn't want to waste more time. Peering through the peephole, I saw a policeman standing outside. "What is it?" I asked loudly through the door.
"I am sorry to disturb you, sir," he said politely. "I wanted to ask you some questions. There was a murder last night in the apartment next door to yours."
I was late for my date. I didn't want to get involved.
"Sorry, officer, I didn't see anything,"
I lied.
"But you may be able to help us," said the policeman.
Did you see anybody suspicious? Can you at least open the door to talk? I wasn't home last night. I lied again. Sorry, officer, I can't help you.
All right, sir,
the policeman responded.
Thank you for your time.
He walked off down the hallway and I continued getting ready for my date. For the next few days, I felt very nervous. My next door neighbor had been murdered. The neighborhood was really unsafe. I was glad I was moving out soon. I also felt very guilty about lying to the policeman. After all, I had seen the murderer. Even though I hadn't seen his face, perhaps there was something I could have told the police that would help them catch the killer. Sometimes crimes are solved by one little detail. One morning before I went to work, I was wondering if the police had managed to solve the case. I turned on the TV and watched the news, but they didn't mention anything about the murder. When I was leaving for work, I noticed a bad smell in the hallway. It seemed to be coming from the apartment next door to mine. I had a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. The hair on the back of my neck stood on end. I went to find the building manager and told him about the smell. When I mentioned the murder, he said there hadn't been any murder in this building. I convinced him to come back up to my floor. When he smelled the stench, he used his master key to open my neighbor's apartment. Both of us were horrified by what we found. The neighbor was on the floor, surrounded by a pool of blood. The smell was overpowering. He had been lying there for days. After analyzing everything, I realized that the rude guy in the lift was the murderer, and he came to my apartment next morning, dressed in police uniform, to perhaps kill me. But thankfully, I didn't open the door, and I was saved. One evening, I was cleaning out my garage when I heard the roar of an engine. A car was speeding through the neighborhood. All of a sudden, there was a screech of tires followed by a loud thump. I ran out onto the street and realized there had been an accident. A young boy had been hit by a car. His small body was lying in the gravel. I immediately took out my cell phone and called an ambulance. As I watched in disbelief, the man who was driving got out and started inspecting the damage to his car. He paid no attention to the injured boy lying under his vehicle. All of a sudden, a woman came running out of her house, screaming and crying. She was obviously the boy's mother. She ran up to the driver and started shaking him. "What have you done?" she cried. "What have you done to my son?" Her anguished scream sent a chill down my spine. The driver roughly pushed her away and started arguing with her. "It's not my fault," he yelled. The boy jumped out in front of me. "Look what he's done to my car. I'll make you pay for this."
"Curse you," the mother screamed. "Curse you. I will never forgive you for this."
The ambulance eventually arrived, but there was nothing they could do for the little boy. He was already dead. The police arrived and tried to determine who was responsible for the accident, but there were no witnesses. They had to accept the driver's version of events. He was not charged with any crime and was allowed to go free. A few days later, the driver sent the boy's mother a bill for the repairs to his car. The front of the car was dented and the headlight was broken. When she refused to pay, he took her to the court. The grief-stricken woman lost the case. Not only did she have to compensate him for the damages to his car, but she also had to pay his legal costs. A few months after the accident, the driver came home from his work to find his wife had disappeared. He called the police and filed a missing persons report, but they couldn't find any trace of her. It was as if she had vanished into thin air. A few days later, the man's two children also went missing. They had been seen leaving their school, but they never arrived home. Somewhere along the way, they had mysteriously disappeared. A few weeks later, the dead body of one of the children was found in a dumpster. When the detectives who were investigating the crime heard about the court case and the little boy who had been killed in the accident, they became suspicious. On a hunch, they questioned the mother of the little boy and obtained a warrant to search her house. They were horrified by what they found. In her living room, the mother had constructed an altar decorated with pictures of the dead boy. Sitting on the altar were the severed heads of the driver's missing wife and child.
The police arrested the mother of the little boy. She confessed that she did it because she wanted revenge. She wanted to torture and make him suffer. She said she sued the dead woman's mouth closed because she made too much noise. She forced the woman to watch as she killed the children in front of her. Then, when she was done, she murdered the woman as well and cut off her head. The mother was found guilty and was given the death penalty. She was executed by hanging. All of this happened because of a damaged car. When my mother was young, she went out on a blind date. Her date took her to a restaurant, and although he was nice enough, she just wasn't into him. Halfway through the meal, she was so bored that she was already thinking of excuses so that she could leave early. The waiter could tell she was bored and kept smiling and winking at her. While my mom's date was in the restroom, the waiter approached her and started asking her if she was okay. She explained that she was on a blind date, but she wasn't having much fun. It turned out that the waiter was just about to get off work. He offered to give my mother a ride home if she waited another 10 minutes. She considered it and was tempted to say yes, but just then her date came back from the restroom. She shook her head, smiled at the waiter and told him, "No thanks." My mom and their date finished their meals and he drove her back home. The next night, my mom happened to be watching the evening news. There was a news flash saying that a woman had been murdered behind a restaurant the night before. She realized it was the same restaurant she had been at with her date. Then they said that the police had already caught the killer. A picture flashed up on the screen. It was the waiter.
My name is Tommy and I think I might be going insane. I grew up in a normal middle class home with loving parents and a sweet little sister. Everything seemed fine until one day when something very strange happened. I came home from school and when I walked into the living room, I saw something that disturbed me. My mother and father were sitting on the couch, smiling and staring at the TV. The weird thing was that the TV wasn't on. Yet, they were staring at it intently. They both turned to look at me and simultaneously said, "Hello, Timmy." My heart leapt into my throat. "My name is Tommy. How could my own parents make a mistake like that? Is everything okay?" I asked nervously. "Everything is perfect, Timmy," my father replied. They were both smiling from ear to ear. It was creepy. I decided to go upstairs to talk to my sister. When I walked into her room, she was lying on her bed, staring at the ceiling. "Have you noticed anything strange about Mom and Dad?" I asked. She smiled at me and said, "No, Timmy, Mom and Dad are just perfect." My blood suddenly ran cold. In anguish, I shouted at her, "My name is Tommy!" Without another word, I backed out of the room. She was still smiling at me as I closed the door. I had no idea what to do. There was definitely something wrong with my entire family. I went into my bedroom and tried to think. I heard my father coming up the stairs. He went into his bedroom and closed the door. I decided to spy on him. So I went into the hallway and peeked through the keyhole. What I saw terrified me. My dad was standing in front of a mirror and he was smiling. His skin was getting pale. His face had turned weird. I was quite sure that wasn't my father. At that moment, he looked into the keyhole. It felt like he looked straight at me. That's when the panic set in. I ran down the stairs and out of the front door. As I was dashing down the driveway, I looked back and saw my mother at the front door. That wasn't my mom. Her skin color had turned the same as the man upstairs. Her face was weird. She was growling like an animal. And my entire family started chasing me. Since then, I have been on the run. All I can do is keep moving. Now that I know their secret, they can't afford to leave me. I keep moving from place to place, begging on the street for spare change. I tried to go to the police, but they wouldn't believe me. They said I was a runaway and tried to bring me back to my parents. I just narrowly managed to escape. I tried to go to the media, but every reporter I spoke just laughed in my face. I am tired of running. I am pretty sure that they killed my real family. My only reason for living now is to get revenge. Can anyone help me? My name is Timmy.
All right, y'all, that is my time. I hope that y'all enjoyed the show. Yes, it was brief. Yes, it was a little short. I'm ending it early. Just got a phone call that was very important. Not going to go into that. But I want to say thanks to all that called in. If I got a DM from you on Instagram, I'm going to answer it after I get off because, you know, I see you. But join me tomorrow, same time, same place. Y'all are greatly appreciated. I love y'all. If you're listening to the playback, I love you as well. Y'all are the thing that keeps me going because, Lord knows, in this world full of snakes, y'all are definitely the real MVPs, like, I swear. But anyway, just like I said, join me same time, same place tomorrow. It's only going to get better from here. It's coming down to the wire because, you know, the 31st is Sunday. I'm going to miss doing these shows for y'all. But I'm going to leave y'all with the thought of the night, and my thought of the night is this. Sometimes people will show you exactly who they are, and you can choose to believe them or you could choose to wear blinders. But just know that if you decide to wear blinders to how a people and how a person treats you and talks to you, it is only your fault when you're blindsided and hit with a low blow that is sure to make you feel some type of way. But don't feel some type of way. Just take some scissors, take the string that connects you to them, and cut it. Love them from a distance. With that being said, love, peace, and blessings. Pray before you lay. I love y'all, and good night.